A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad to be with you on the program today. Normally, it is pretty quiet where I live in rural Virginia until your neighbors decide to start logging. So you may hear the sound of a saw in the background. I've got all my windows closed, trying to keep things as quiet as possible. But it is not bucolic here in rural central Virginia today. And I hope that they get all their work done very soon because it is really, really annoying. All right. You know, it's too bad they don't have suppressors for chainsaws. You know, that's all I'm saying. All right. On today's program, we're going to be talking with Costas Moros from the Second Amendment Foundation, discussing Baird versus Bonta, the Ninth Circuit decision, declaring California's ban on urban open carry unconstitutional, without really addressing the licensing for open carry in California's rural counties. They didn't really get into the constitutionality of those licenses, although there was a concurring opinion that did note that it appears that no such licenses have been issued, which would be a problem. But we'll talk with Costas about that. I want to get Costas's take as well on the cost of getting your concealed carry permit in California. I had a great thread on X the other day talking about not only Santa Clara County, where it costs you about $2,000 to get licensed, but even the more reasonable jurisdictions like San Francisco, where it's only $1,000 or so, adding in the cost of the mandated psychological fee, the cost of the firearms training, the cost of the application itself. Again, should it cost you four figures to exercise a fundamental right? I don't think so. Santa Clara County, though, says, hey, you know what? We're just passing these costs on to the applicant, right? This is what it costs us to do to run the background checks and everything else. Which we'll talk about with Costas, but even if that is true, and I don't think it is, even if that is true, then what's to stop a jurisdiction from imposing so many requirements that come with a financial cost that, again, people are priced out of their right to keep and bear arms? And then the justification is, well, I mean, listen, this is just the cost of us, you know, doing our due diligence. At some point, this becomes an exorbitant fee. It becomes unconstitutional, even under a shall issue system. And I would say that point has long been passed in Santa Clara County, where $2,000 is what it takes to get you your carry permit. Anyway, without further ado, let's kick off the conversation with Costas Moros. Take a look and a listen. Costas, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you too, Cam. Always a pleasure to be on.
I have a feeling it's going to be a very, very busy year for you and Second Amendment litigants. And we sort of closed out the year. I think we closed out the year. Maybe we started the year on a high note. I can't remember when Baird versus Bonta came down. This was January the 2nd, right? It was last Friday when Baird versus
Bonta. Yeah, it was just after the holiday.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, one of the couple of days I took off. So I was a little confused about that. So we kicked off 2026 with a very good decision out of the Ninth Circuit, one that you were widely quoted. I love the fact that New York Times is reading you on X, and
I guess so.
Other folks are reading you on X because your take was good decision, probably going to get reversed by an en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit, right?
Yeah, it's a good decision with a very short life expectancy, frankly, but it is a good decision. And we shouldn't, just because the Ninth Circuit isn't the Ninth Circuit, it doesn't mean we shouldn't give good rulings their due, because they can still be influential outside of the Ninth Circuit. Other judges read them. They can be cited as persuasive authority, that kind of thing.
So, absolutely. Yeah. And so I got to say, I didn't even realize that California's open carry laws were so convoluted. So there's a ban on open carry in California counties that have more than 200,000 people, right?
And
then,
correct.
And then in counties with less than 200,000 people, you can carry, but you have to have a permit. And that permit is only good for that county. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, and that would be a concern, except that no such permit has ever been issued as far as we know. So yes, in theory, there is a provision in the law saying open carry permits can be issued in counties of under 200,000 people, so the rural counties, and they're only good in that county. However, as far as we are aware, no such permit has ever been issued. And those sheriffs pretty much just say, just get a CCW permit. And kind of understandably, because it creates some confusion. And they probably, I think a lot of the sheriffs, it's not necessarily that they're opposed to open carry. It's just that they're probably trying to do a solid by the people applying. Like, why do you want an open carry permit? It's only good in this county. You may as well get a CCW permit. Because remember, under the provisions of the law, you can't actually get both on one. You have to choose one or the other. So it makes sense in that sense to have the CCW that's valid statewide. That said, that this is why this case was brought, because of all these complications.
So, yeah. And so the panel decides that the open carry ban in urban counties is unconstitutional. They don't really get into the licensing aspect of the lawsuit. I think there was they said that there was an issue with standing there, right, if I'm not mistaken. But when it comes to the ban on urban carrying, the panel concluded that, yes, even though California technically has a shall issue system for concealed carry, that doesn't mean that they can just forbid open carry outright.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They can't forbid it outright like they have in all these counties, and that became the in the populous counties, which became the heart of this case because of the as applied issues with the counties that are under 200,000 people. Yeah.
So California had argued, and we've seen this, I guess, come up in other jurisdictions. The Supreme Court in Bruin did not really, they didn't talk about a concealed carry license. They talked about the right to publicly carry, right? But when they were going through the history and the tradition of the right to publicly carry, they certainly suggested that in the 19th century, there were prohibitions on concealed carry, but those prohibitions on concealed carry did not extend to open carry, which I guess suggests that one form of carry could be banned, but not the other. And that was sort of what California was hanging its hat on. What was the panel's response to that argument?
The panel's response was that is a too general way of looking at things, because carry has been a thing for as long as the U.S. has been a thing. So it's not a new problem. It's not some new technology. There's actually no leeway to go to this more general standard, these broader analogs. What you're left with is the California has to find distinctly similar historical laws. That's what Bruin says you have to do when there isn't a new problem presented. And what the panel basically concluded, looking at the historical cases from the 19th century, was that actually, no, they didn't consider the two forms of carry fungible. It wasn't like you could just have one or the other. They specifically and repeatedly said that open carry is what the Constitution protects, not concealed carry. So governments are free to restrict concealed carry if they want to, but open carry can't be restricted. What they did not say was, well, you know, they could ban one or the other, but you have to allow the other. So because you ban concealed carry, you have to allow open carry. That's not what the ruling said in these cases. So that's what the panel was focused on. The right was understood to be a right of open carry at the time.
We saw a state court in Florida reach a similar conclusion regarding a challenge to that state's ban on open carry. And basically the panel suggested there that, if any form of carry is protected, it is open carry. Does this open up a can of worms, Costas, where maybe there's an anti-gun state like California that says, all right, then no more concealed carry. If you want to carry, you got to do it openly.
In theory, yes, but that's not actually going to happen because it's too clever by half. They won't be able to explain to their base and to Giffords in every town, oh yeah, we're just going to let people open carry and it'll be a great way to undermine the right to carry. It would be a clever thing to do, but it's just too hard to explain, to anti-gun people in Los Angeles and San Francisco why Newsom is suddenly allowing open carry. It's not going to actually happen. So okay. I'm not really worried about that. That said, that would be the clever thing to do if they were bold enough.
Yeah. And I guess, this does raise the possibility that the Supreme Court will have to address this at some point, right? Revisit Bruin and lay out specifically whether or not both forms of carry are protected by the Constitution, whether one or the other would suffice, or whether open carry really is the only constitutionally protected form of carriage.
Yeah, and I don't think they necessarily will, because they're, I think after this gets unbonked, and I hope I'm wrong, but I'm almost sure it will be unbonked. There won't be a circuit split that I know of on this. Maybe there is some old federal circuit decision I'm forgetting. So I don't think the Supreme Court's going to jump on this. That said, if they ever were forced to, maybe there is some circuit split, or there will be, that I'm forgetting. I suspect it's not going to go our way. I don't think the Supreme Court wants to force nationwide open carry. I think that's a step too far for them. And I think they do what they did in Bruin, which is, in Bruin, they lay out this great historical test. It's very well rooted in originalism. And then they throw in a footnote saying, oh, and concealed carry permitting is fine. And it's like, that's nowhere supported in history. So the Supreme Court is not adverse to making carve outs to their own test when it suits them. And I could also see them saying, just for expediency, that, oh, yeah, you can ban one form of carry and allow the other. You know, that's what the historical tradition supports, even though, as Judge Van Dyke excellently wrote about in his opinion, that's not what the history says. The history is very clear that open carry is what the prior generations thought was protected. And with some luck, maybe Judge Van Dyke will someday be Justice Van Dyke, and he can go tell them himself. You know, we'll see.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and I guess, I mean, again, I'm not an attorney, but you know, the Supreme Court has said that arms that weren't around in 1791 are protected or can be protected by the Second Amendment. So maybe you can make the argument that even if concealed carry wasn't what the founding generation was thinking about, or even those in, you know, the mid-1800s, that that this modern form of carriage, which now dominates the way we carry, right? The vast majority of us who carry, I think, carry concealed. Maybe that means that it is protected under the Second Amendment. Again, I don't know. And maybe the court takes up this case. Maybe they don't. But I do want to talk more about concealed carry in California, because there's ongoing litigation, but you got the DOJ's lawsuit against the LA Sheriff's Department. You got CRPA and the company's lawsuit against the LASD. And the lawsuit has been filed now against Santa Clara County, right?
Yes, yes. The reason you haven't heard more about that is we decided against going for a preliminary injunction as we normally did in the past. And that's because of Lackey v. Stinney. I won't get into it here, but pretty much the Supreme Court said you can't get attorney's fees if you only win a preliminary injunction. So at this point, unless it's something urgent, we always have to try and just go for a final judgment rather than a preliminary injunction.
Okay. You had a great thread on X the other day talking about the cost of carry and how wildly it varies across the state. So Santa Clara, probably the worst offender in the state, right? I mean, all told, it's going to cost you about $2,000 to get a concealed carry permit when you factor in the application fee itself. I think is like $1,100.
It's 900, 1,000, somewhere there. It's a lot. Yeah.
And then you've got your mandatory psychological evaluation. You've got the cost of training, obviously. And you know, just, you know, nearby San Francisco, I won't call it reasonable, but it's about half the cost mm-hmm. that it is in Santa Clara, right? So,
yes.
So how can these counties get away with charging, again, an arm and a leg for people to exercise a fundamental right?
Well, California law allows them to recoup what their actual costs are with their local application fee. And Santa Clara is claiming that the 908, whatever it is, roughly $1,000 for their application fee is their actual costs of doing all of SB2's requirements, the interview, the reviewing references, et cetera. That's a little hard to believe when San Francisco charges under $200 for the same fee. And it's not like San Francisco is interested in subsidizing the Second Amendment, you know. And even other counties that are expensive, we see some at $300, $400. But $1,000 just for the basic application fee before the training course, before the psych exam, before the live scan, that's preposterous, you know. So and we argue, by the way, that even if that were their real fee, let's say it really was true that they were spending $1,000, that's their problem. Bruin is clear that you can't use exorbitant fees to deny the right to carry, even if it is the real cost. That's the government's problem. They decided to impose all these requirements and all this investigation. If Santa Clara doesn't like all the work they have to do, they should go take it up with Sacramento and tell them, hey, legislator, repeal all this stuff you're making us do and just let us do your... Because remember, this is all in addition to the background check, which the state DOJ does. When you do your live scan, you do the whole background check and all that. So they're just making these police departments do extra work. That said, I don't concede that that is their actual cost because, again, all these other departments, including San Francisco, go do it for far cheaper.
Is it still the case in California that police departments, you know, they have the stuff that they're mandated to do, but then they also have stuff that they can do? I know, for instance, the psychological evaluation at one point was optional. Not every county was requiring that. Is that now required under SB2?
No, it is not. So what SB2 did with the psych exam is the psych exam used to be capped at $150. So you could only charge applicants $150. They uncapped that. So counties that choose to require it can charge whatever they want for it. It's usually around $400 or $500. But most counties still don't require it. Not even LA, not San Diego, not Orange County, but the Bay Area counties all do. So, you know, that's Santa Clara, San Francisco, et cetera. And I think it's being misunderstood. Like what the law says about the psych exam, and I don't concede it's ever okay, but it seems to be written that the sheriff may require an applicant to take a psych exam. And I think that's intended for a situation where the sheriff might think, well, I don't know about this person. He seems a little unstable. Let's make this applicant do a psych exam. But what they're doing is they're saying across the board, every applicant in these counties has to do a psych exam, not just the ones where we suspect might be unstable. So that's being abused in that way. It's supposed to be a case by case basis thing, and it's just being applied to everyone. So for example, Santa Clara's psych exam costs $417. It's a 3-hour multiple choice test. It's the same one they do to cops. I forget what it's called, but it's the same one cops take. So you do your 300, 400 questions, whatever it is, and then you have a interview with a psychologist afterwards after they review your questions. It's very silly. It takes a lot of time and it's very invasive. But that's California for you.
Yeah, that is California for you. And that's Santa Clara for you. And you know, and that's given the history of permitting abuse in Santa Clara. I mean, that just, to me, this just adds insult to injury, right? I mean, the former sheriff, Lori Smith, was convicted in a civil jury trial of corruption related to the issuing of concealed carry permits. Basically, if you were a VIP, you could get a permit. If you were an average applicant, your application got shoved in a drawer somewhere and forgotten about. There was testimony from individuals who, you know, had stalkers, domestic violence victims who had applied for a concealed carry permit, never heard back from the sheriff's department. Meanwhile, Apple executives are getting permits if they say, yeah, you know, we'll give you some iPads for the department. I mean, that was going on before Bruin, right? And it was virtually impossible for the average citizen to get a concealed carry permit. Bruin comes along, says this may issue system is constitutionally unsound. Santa Clara adopts this, you know, supposedly shall issue system. But now they're pricing people out of the right to carry. And you can't tell me that charging somebody $2,000 to exercise a fundamental right is not going to have a chilling effect on the number of people who can afford to exercise that right.
No, that's totally true. In fact, when the Santa Clara County Council was adopting the fee increase, because even before they were expensive, but it was about $500 for the fee, now it's $1,000. So when they were adopting that fee, the NAACP chapter actually showed up to oppose it and talked about how it could disproportionately affect, you know, minority communities. And the county council basically said, okay, we'll keep an eye on that. We'll see how it plays out. It's like, how do you think it's going to play out, guys? Of course it's going to be, harmful. And, you know, this is especially aggravating in the context of California, where the attorney general sued Huntington Beach because they passed a simple voter ID requirement. And he argued, well, this is going to, you know, disenfranchise poor people and this and that. But the attorney general isn't doing anything about high fees or long wait times for CCW permits. Hell, on the wait times, there's even a state law. He could come in and enforce the 120-day time limit. Only he can enforce it. We can't enforce the state penal code, but he refuses to. So the hypocrisy is just off the charts here.
Yeah, and he may be running for governor soon, I understand.
Yeah, it's going to be him and 30 other people. We'll see who wins, I guess. But we'll have to see how that plays out to see who our next dictator is out here in California.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, listen, Costas, I appreciate you coming on the program. I always appreciate your insight, and I know the audience does as well. I'll just ask before we let you go, any other cases out there that are percolating that you think we should be keeping an eye on in the next week or two?
Well, we just got news. Yeah, Saf did an amicus brief in Rhodey, the ammunition background check, last week. And we just got news last night that the U.S. DOJ submitted an amicus brief. So that's very exciting. Always exciting when they get involved in a case. So that one is going to argument along with Yuka Taki in the Ninth Circuit en banc. And I think it's March.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we're looking forward to the Wolford oral arguments in 2 weeks. So that'll be fun as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Costas Morris with the Second Amendment Foundation. Thank you so much for your time, sir. Look forward to doing this again soon.
Thanks, Cam. Always a pleasure.
My thanks to Costas for joining us on the program. By the way, I've got chainsaws in the background. I've got a rooster on my porch right now, so you may hear a crow or two. Just not a quiet morning here at Casa del Edwards. All right. On to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We're actually going to continue talking about the recidivist report we discussed yesterday. This teacher in North Carolina who was murdered inside her own home. The man who was arrested for this crime, she was actually on the phone with 911 when she was assaulted. By the time police got there, she had suffered a grievous injury. She passed away at the hospital. 36-year-old Ryan Camacho was arrested, charged with her murder. He's got a rap sheet, I guess, at least 20 arrests, including an incident where last month in December, he was charged with breaking and entering. He was ruled incompetent to stand trial, and a judge just let him free. Instead of accepting the prosecutor's request to have Camacho involuntarily committed, the judge said, nope, we're just going to cut him loose instead. So this, as you can imagine, has become a big story in North Carolina. And Governor Josh Stein reacting to the murder of this teacher by saying that jail's not the right place. We need to treat folks. Talking again about the... not only the lengthy criminal history of Ryan Camacho, but the, quote, history of mental health challenges that Camacho has had, according to court records. Stein said, obviously not everybody with mental health challenges are a violent risk, but there are some who are. And we're not doing a good enough job of treating those folks. Well, no, not when you've got judges letting them loose. According to WRAL, Camacho, again, not only has a lengthy criminal history going back a decade in both Wake and Durham counties, where he's been arrested more than 20 times, but he does have a history of mental illness. His mom, Cynthia Camacho, sought and actually was granted guardianship over him multiple times, citing incompetency. Again, he was declared incompetent to stand trial in that breaking and entering charge back in December after a mental competency examination. And again, the judge was asked, hey, can you involuntarily commit this guy? And he said, no. District attorney in Wake County, Lauren Freeman, said, well, someone can be found not capable to proceed and yet determine that they're not an imminent threat to themselves or others. Okay, sure. But again, if you're incompetent to stand trial for crimes you allegedly committed, then doesn't the state have an obligation to try to restore competency so that you can be held accountable for your actions? Because remember, it's not like Camacho pled not guilty by reason of insanity to breaking and entering. The case didn't go that far. He didn't even get a chance to say, well, you can't hold me accountable because I was insane at the time. He was declared incompetent to assist in his own defense. So at that point, I think the state does have an obligation to restore competency, or at least to attempt to restore competency. And by the way, the fact that Mr. Camacho has more than 20 arrests to his name, when the DA says, well, someone can be found not capable to proceed to trial and yet determine that they're not an imminent threat to themselves or others. I don't know. Does the 20 arrests figure into that at all? Because it seems to me that if you're looking at whether or not someone's an imminent risk, you might want to look at their past criminal history. And Ryan Camacho's past criminal history clearly suggests that, yes, he in fact is a danger to himself or others. Now, I don't entirely disagree with Josh Stein that more needs to be done to help those with mental illness, including those with a propensity for violence. But again, let's not excuse or overlook the failure of the criminal justice system. Now, if the judge said, look, there's no room in the inn, right? We got no space for Mr. Camacho. I'd love to put him behind bars in an institution, but there are no beds available for him. Now, that might be what happened here. I don't know. But again, the answer there is building out more space for these individuals, right? It's not about passing a red flag law, which Josh Stein supports. It's not about imposing new gun control restrictions on lawful gun owners, which Josh Stein supports. It's about ensuring that, again, those who commit violent crimes can either go to trial and be held accountable for those crimes, or, again, if they are incompetent to stand trial, that they can receive treatment so that they are not a danger to themselves or others. And in this case, neither one of those things happened. And I'm not impressed with the happy talk by Governor Stein. He should be pissed at what happened. Zoe Welch did not need to die. She did not deserve to die. And Josh Stein is again talking about, we have to do a better job with this intersection between folks out there who are paranoid, they're delusional, who can pose risks. Dude, read the room. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, because if I keep talking about this, I'm just going to get more and more ticked off. Let's stay in North Carolina. Two men charged in attempted robbery of Winston-Salem business that led to one of them being shot by an employee. A case of self-defense, by the way, in a Winston-Salem, South Carolina, or North Carolina, excuse me. This actually happened back on December 20th. It was at a place called Cooper Lake Cannabis. Police got called out to reports of a business robbery and a shooting. Police said that the two masked suspects forced their way into the business while armed in an apparent attempt to commit a robbery. An employee, though, near the entrance was also armed and fired at the suspects, striking one of them. Police identified 28-year-old Bryson Aaron Vance Harrison and 36-year-old Charles Eugene Robinson Jr. as the two suspects involved in the attempted robbery. They say that Harrison suffered non-life-threatening gunshot wounds during the incident after he forced entry into the business while armed and wearing a mask. He was arrested on the night of the incident, charged with felony attempted robbery of a dangerous weapon, felony possession of a stolen firearm, and misdemeanor assault with a deadly weapon. Police said that Harrison also had an outstanding warrant for arrest that was served, receiving a total bond of $103,500. Officers later located Charles Eugene Robinson at a home in Winston-Salem. They said a search warrant was executed at the residence and on a vehicle that Robinson was seen leaving the business in. During the search, they recovered marijuana and drug paraphernalia. Robinson arrested and charged with felony attempted robbery with a dangerous weapon, misdemeanor possession of marijuana, misdemeanor possession of marijuana paraphernalia, and a misdemeanor maintaining a dwelling for the purpose of violating the Controlled Substances Act. According to WFMY News, following further investigation, police said the shooting appears to have been an act of self-defense by the employee of the business. As a result, they say no charges will be filed in connection with the shooting itself, and in accordance with state law. The employee's name has not been released because he was the victim of a crime. So there you go. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A resident of Joplin, Missouri, who has been awarded the Fire Department Chief's Cross for his life-saving actions not long ago. And this is a heck of a story. Mark Crandall received this award at the Joplin City Council meeting. Crandall was actually at a stoplight, just in his car, waiting to go on through the intersection, when he saw a house on fire. And then he noticed that there was actually a teenager standing on kind of like a second floor balcony near the roof. Smoke is billowing out. Crandall drove, I don't know if he waited for the light to turn, but he drove over to the house, grabbed a ladder off of his truck, climbed up, and actually saved this teenager. If Crandall had not been there by the time fire crews arrived, it might have been too late for this teen. And Mark Crandall, again, awarded the Chief's Cross at the Joplin City Council meeting this week for his life-saving actions, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Mark Crandall, we thank you for your very good deed. Now, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I do want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. I will say there's a lot of stuff going on right now. You know, we've got all kinds of legal news, very important Supreme Court conference coming up this week, a number of Second Amendment cases under consideration. You've got oral arguments coming up in Wolford versus Lopez later this month. We also are about a week, a little bit more than a week away from the deadline for bills to be filed in Virginia. We are still waiting to see the permit to purchase bill, waiting period bills, the ban on so-called assault and large capacity magazines. We know those bills are coming, and we know more of them are coming. But Democrats have been basically keeping quiet about their anti-gun plans this session. They are leaning into affordability. They're talking a lot about cost of living. But the gun control is coming. We know that it is. And we'll be paying very close attention to what's going on in Virginia and other state capitals around the country as lawmakers are starting to head back to work. We will be seeing both pro-gun bills introduced as well as attacks on our right to keep bear arms. We'll be covering all of them for you at bearingarms.com. So be sure to check out the website in addition to checking out Bearing Arms, Cam & Company each and every day. Certainly do appreciate you being a part of the program and being a reader to the website. And if you like what you see, I would also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. Just use the promo code FIGHT. When you go to bearingarms.com/subscribe, you can get 60% off your VIP membership. And you get all kinds of great benefits at every tier of support. But no matter which tier you choose, thank you for supporting the work we're doing here at Bearing Arms. Look forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the rest of your 2A Tuesday. I'll be on with Carl Higbee on Newsmax in the 6 p.m. Eastern hour tonight. And we'll see you back here on Wednesday. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.